Okay, everyone. So, the weather is beautiful. I've seen the weather outside. It's marvelous. Yeah, really nice. So, when the weather is good, it's good. When the weather is bad, it's also good. Yeah? So that's the nice thing here. So, let us continue and come to the last part of these suttas. And today we're going to have a look at the Anapanasati Sutta, the famous sutta on mindfulness of breathing. And this, when I say famous, when I say a sutta is important, the reason I say that is because it occurs in many, many places in the Tipitaka. You find the sutta in different versions, different contexts, taught to different people. You find it in the Chinese Agamas. You also find this Anapanasati Sutta. You find many different versions of it. And because of that, you know that it is a significant sutta. Otherwise, it wouldn't be taught in so many different contexts. And it is interesting, you may wonder, how come we do this sutta at the very end? Shouldn't we do this at the beginning? Yeah, we've been doing a meditation retreat, shouldn't we be teaching the meditation straight away? And in a sense, we did that on the first day, but the idea here is to teach the path systematically, so that you do all the preliminary things first, and the preliminary things is to have the right outlook, right view at the very beginning of the path. The preliminary things is to purify the mind from the coarse defilements. That's why we talked about the how to overcome ill will and these kind of things. And only when the mind is prepared, when you have practiced the preliminary aspects, is actually real meditation possible. And it's one of the things that you will see when we come to the sutta. So in the Noble Eightfold Path, meditation is step number 7. And before you get to step number 7, you have to work on the previous 6 steps. And then 7 and 8 come as a consequence. And that's why we're doing it now. And this is the reason how kind of this whole thing fits together. Another thing about the Anapanasati Sutta, why we're doing it now, we talked a little bit about Satipatthana before. And Anapanasati is the way that Satipatthana is fulfilled. And I've mentioned this many times already. But if you want to know one simple, direct, immediate way of practicing Satipatthana, it's actually Anapanasati. And the Buddha says as much. So if the Buddha says so, well, then we should probably take his word for it, that this is the way to do it. So let's have a look at this sutta. It's found in the middle length sayings of the Buddha, number 118. And this is just an extract. I always use extracts because the suttas are sometimes quite long, and a lot of the material is not so crucial for whatever we're doing at the time. So this is why I prefer to use extracts. So this is what the Buddha has to say. Bhikkhus, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the 4 applications of mindfulness. When the 4 applications of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the 7 factors of awakening. When the 7 factors of awakening are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and liberation, or deliverance, if you like. So this is just the starting point. This is to how the Buddha, what the Buddha says to get us a little bit excited about mindfulness of breathing. He kind of promises the results straight away. And when the Buddha says it is of great fruit and great benefit, then you can take it. It really is a great fruit and great benefit. The Buddha doesn't normally mince his words. If he says something, usually the Buddha is understated. He doesn't. He's like the English are often understated. The Buddha is a bit like that. It's understated. I'm not saying that the Buddha is English. I'm just saying, you know, there is a similarity there. So he's understated. And this is when the Buddha says, "Oh, this is happiness." It means it is really, really happy. When, for example, in the 3rd jhana, I haven't actually taught the jhanas how they are described in the suttas, but the way the Buddha talks about the jhanas, he says, when you come to the 3rd jhana, this is the thing, the noble ones, they say about the 3rd jhana, when you get there, you're happy. But when you get to the 3rd jhana, you're not just happy, you are really, 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 really happy. You are. It is actually the highest kind of happiness that is experienceable in samsara. That is when the Buddha says, "Oh, you feel happy when you get there. Finally, you're happy. Anything before that is like temporary happiness." So when the Buddha says that something is of great fruit and great benefit, it means the highest great fruit, the highest benefit. And that is why it leads all the way to awakening here. And this is an important thing to remember when you read the suttas on your own, is that the Buddha is understated. So when he says something, you can very often you can assume it has a very high meaning. It actually means something very profound. So remember that. Not always, but very often that is the case. And you can then tell from the context, usually, how to interpret these things. But this case, obviously, it means something very high here. So what is it then? So first of all, the mindfulness of breathing fulfills the four applications of mindfulness. Again, I don't like this foundation, so I translate application instead. It fulfills it. It means that there is nothing else you have to do. This is all you have to do. You don't have to worry about anything. This is the complete practice of all the four applications of mindfulness, just by watching the breath. And then everything is not just about the body contemplation, all the contemplations, Vedana, feeling, mind objects, everything is included by watching the humble breath. It's so easy. All you have to do is watch the breath. How could anything be easier than that? And still, it isn't. It's easy, but it's not easy. You know what I mean? It's simple, but it's not easy. You have to kind of learn how to deal with this gradually. And then when you fulfill the four applications of mindfulness, or the four focuses of mindfulness, that fulfills the seven factors of awakening. The seven factors of awakening, these are the qualities of mind that lead to awakening. Once you have established these seven qualities of the mind, awakening is very, very close. The seven factors of awakening are all about samadhi practice. We talked about them the other day, the sati, sambodhanga, the factor of awakening, which is mindfulness, leading all the way up to the upekkha sambodhanga. And the upekkha sambodhanga is a factor of awakening, which is similar to the fourth jhana. So very high steps of samadhi here. And that is where you are on the cusp of making the breakthrough to awakening itself. You're so close. Your mind is so incredibly powerful. It's so extraordinarily stable that you are able to deal with anything, even profound insights like non-self. These are very difficult insights because they are so contrary to how we normally see the world. And that's why it's incredibly challenging to see these things. So you need a very, very stable mind. And this is why samadhi is so important to be able to make these breakthroughs. You need that stability to be able to deal with it, basically. Once you deal with it, you wonder, how come I never saw this before? It's so blooming obvious. I've been so deluded all the time. And you feel so happy once you've seen it. It's such a good thing to see. But actually being able to do it is actually hard because it's so contrary to our habits and the way we normally look at the world. And then from that, then you get this true knowledge, the te vidya, the real insight into reality and liberation. You are liberated. Liberated from what? Liberated from dukkha. Liberated from defilements, liberated from rebirth, liberated from all of these things. In other words, that sounds kind of negative, but of course what it implies, if you're liberated from dukkha, you have the highest happiness. It's two sides of the same coin. When suffering is gone, you have the highest happiness instead. So this here is the what we have to do. And all you have to do is watch the breath to reach the highest happiness in the world. Isn't that marvelous? Simplifies things so much. So as I was saying the other day, practice kindness. But you have to be really committed to that. Kindness in its broadest possible application. Then watch the breath. Watch the breath in the right way. It leads to all these things that we're going to have a look at now in a second. And then awakening happens. It's simple. At the same time, it's very profound also. Okay, so let's have a look at this. What the Buddha has to say about this, how to do this. And how, bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen, how is mindfulness of breathing developed and cultivated so that it is of great fruit and great benefit? Here, a bhikkhu, a bhikkhuni, a layman, a laywoman, gone to the forest or to the root of a tree or to an empty hut, sits down, having folded their legs crosswise, they set their body erect and establish mindfulness in front of them. Ever mindful, they breathe in. Ever mindful, they breathe out. So this is the preliminary thing we have to do before we start the mindfulness of breathing. Yeah. And this part is actually probably the most important part of the whole sutta. Why? Because if you get the preliminaries right, the rest of the mindfulness of breathing, I was telling you on the very first day that the meditation practice is really automatic. Yeah, it happens by itself. It requires no willpower. It doesn't require any effort on our part. In fact, it requires the exact opposite. It requires our ability to stand back and allow things to be passengers, to be passive observers. So because everything else is automatic, then what we do beforehand becomes the critical thing. Once the preliminary things are established in the right way, then the automatic process happens. If the preliminary things are not established, this automatic process does not happen. And how deep we go in this automatic process will depend on how powerfully those preliminary conditions are established. The more powerful they are, the more pure we are in our conduct and everyday life and all of these things, the more clear our outlook is in accordance with the Buddha's teachings, the more automatic this process will be and the deeper it will go as a consequence. So what are these things then? And I've talked about these things already, so I will probably mention them fairly briefly now. So the first thing you see here, gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, to an empty hut. Yeah, this is what this means is that meditation is something, when it is done properly, it happens in solitude. This is really what it means. And this is the classical way at the time of the Buddha, that you would do solitude. Yeah, you go to, these days, mostly empty hut. Not so many people sit at the root of a tree. You may do it temporarily, if not all the time. So an empty hut in the forest is really the ideal situation. So what about coming to the Kaduri Sen? Does that count as an empty hut? Not quite an empty hut, but it is a good halfway house. Yeah, it is a good halfway between the household life and the monastic life. It's pretty good here, I have to say. It is very peaceful. You come out of your ordinary life, and once you come out of your ordinary life and you go to a special place like this, it's easier to put your ordinary life behind you. Yeah, your job and your family, you can leave it a little bit behind. If you stay in your apartment, it's much more difficult to leave those things behind, because everything around you reminds you of your family, your work and everything. Here, nothing really reminds you of that. Here, everything reminds you of the Buddha, the Dhamma, yeah, and the practitioners. So everything kind of inclines you in the right direction. This is a good halfway house. And it's very, I've said this many times, but actually it's very nice here. Some people say, oh, this is the cheapest place in Hong Kong, but it's a pretty damn, no, I shouldn't say, it's pretty good, yeah, for a cheap place. There was one of the previous abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery before Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm was the builder in the early days of Bodhinyana Monastery. And he would go to this previous abbot. He ended up disrobing, unfortunately. This is now 25 years ago or something. His name was Ajahn Jagaro. And whenever Ajahn Brahm went to him, I want to build this building. And then Ajahn Jagaro would say, well, get the cheapest and the best. Usually it doesn't work like that. But I think Kaduri Center is a bit like that. It's the cheapest and the best. That's what I reckon. It's pretty, pretty good. Especially when you sit in here. It's actually very nice, very peaceful and beautiful. So this is a good halfway house. So we don't expect ideal situations. It's very hard to come across ideal circumstances. If you want ideal situations, you really have to become a monastic. Yeah, I must admit, in the monastery in Perth, when I go back to my little cootie in the forest, it's pretty good. It doesn't get much better than that. When I am in my forest, in my cootie in the forest in the monastery, I'm almost completely secluded. I can't see any other cooties or anything like that. It's very nice. But even there sometimes, it's not as quiet as it is here. Because there is a highway a couple of kilometers away, and when the wind comes in the wrong direction, I can hear the cars, yeah? So actually this, in some ways, it's just as good as my cootie. In other ways, not as good. But you can see, there's always a bit of give and take. But the point is, meditation, real meditation, if it's going to be profound, happens in solitude. You have to withdraw the mind from the hustle and bustle of daily life, withdraw it from the sensuality of the world, and then this ability to become peaceful and profound reaches its highest possibility. There is a reason for this, yeah, and this is how the Buddha lays it down in right there in the Anapanasati Sutta. So you find a suitable place, you sit down. Mindfulness of breathing is usually done in the sitting down posture. And again, there is a reason for that. Walking, it's very hard to watch the breath. And you can't go as deep in walking as you can when you sit. So sitting is a preferred posture. And having folded your legs crosswise. And again, the idea of sitting with your legs crossed is that it's a very, once you get used to the posture, it's actually very nice and very stable and also quite comfortable. After a while, your legs will hurt. I mean, they will hurt whatever posture you take, they will hurt. But it's a nice posture if you can do it. But it is not absolutely required. One of the reasons why this is specified in the Anapanasati Sutta is because at that time in India, this was considered a comfortable posture for people. They would sit cross-legged, it was comfortable. In the modern world, yeah, most people are not accustomed to sitting cross-legged. It took me a long time to get used to this, because I wasn't used to this. When I grew up, I never sat cross-legged. I would sit on chairs and that kind of stuff. So don't feel obliged. Remember, the ideal posture that we have in meditation is a posture that allows the body to disappear. That's the ideal posture. It is not cross-legged or sitting on a chair or standing on your head or whatever. I wouldn't recommend standing on your head, by the way. Don't do that one. That's too dangerous. But the ideal posture is the one where your body disappears. Yeah, that is what we want to do. And sitting cross-legged is not magical so that you will get into jhana just then, especially not if you have a lot of pain and problems. And remember, you can change your posture. You can sit on the chair for a while, then sit on the floor for a while, and then do whatever else for a while, whatever you find suitable. Yeah, this is how you. This is the right way of doing it. So this is the way I look at this. So you can see there's a bit of interpretation going into this, and this is why I'm drawing these things out a little bit to you. Then you have the idea of setting your body erect. Again, do this at the right time. Don't force yourself to sit straight away. Sometimes you feel tired, and sitting straight may actually be too much of a stress on your body. So sometimes just start out by leaning back. Yeah, lean back against the wall, lean back against the chair. Yeah, if you want to, one of the secrets of Bodhinyana, not a secret actually, we don't have many secrets, but Ajahn Brahm always says that when he starts out his meditation, because he works a lot and works very hard, so often he feels tired. Yeah, it is natural. It doesn't matter how developed you are, if you work hard, you feel tired. So he always says, when I start out my meditation, he says, he leans back against the wall. And he leans back until the mindfulness comes back, the energy comes back in the mind. And then you will find that when the mindfulness returns, it's almost as if you want to sit straight. Because sitting straight actually sharpens up that mindfulness even more. It is natural to want to sit straight when you have reasonably good mindfulness. So remember that. Don't force yourself to do anything unnatural. When it feels natural to sit straight, then do it. If it feels that you're pushing yourself too much, then relax first of all, and then sit straight afterwards. So if you want to do a little bit of meditation in your daily life, if you enjoy that, make sure you are sensitive to your body, sensitive to your needs. Do things your own way. Don't follow a kind of boilerplate kind of instruction which is always the same, because every day is a little bit different, every person is a little bit different. Feel your needs in your body and your mind, and then you're doing it according to your individual requirements. So and then the last one, and this is the most important one of all, having established mindfulness in front of you. Yeah, Parimukkang Satting Upata Petva is the Pali for that. And Parimukkang, the word Parimukka is one of these words that is often debated. Some people say that it means the tip of the nose, yeah, or it means the upper lip. So in certain meditation traditions, you're told, watch your breath here. Why? Because it says so in the Anapanasati Sutta. Parimukkang means here. And this is the interpretation of the commentaries. They say it means there. And that's why it is followed in this way. But it is here, again, we have to be careful, because if you try to force attention too much at the beginning of your meditation practice, forcing it on to too small an area, and perhaps even finding it difficult to feel the breath right there. Some people find it very hard. Some people find it natural. So I have always followed Ajahn Brahm's interpretation. That is, you just know the breath. Breathe in. Breathe out. Yeah, you know that you're breathing in, and you know that you're breathing out. You don't have to focus on any particular part of the body. All you have to do is know that the breath is going in. I know it. I don't know exactly how I know it, but I know it, and that's good enough. Yeah. And this is what you focus on, just that knowledge that is going in and out. You don't narrow it down too much at the beginning, because if you do, it can cause problems. The reason why I think the commentary says focusing on the nose is that actually that is what ultimately happens. It happens naturally, automatically. That is where the feeling arises. But it doesn't mean that we should actually place our attention there, because it should be an automatic process again. It just happens by itself. After a while, that is actually where you feel the breath. You may not even know that you feel the breath there, but that's actually what happens. So just go with the breath. Parimukkang, some people argue, according to how it's used in the suttas, that it just means here in the present moment, in the present space, right here. In other words, in front of you, yeah? Like here, in the current space, at the current time, in the present moment. That's really all it means. So do it this way. Yeah? And then you have to establish this sati. You have to establish the mindfulness. So how do we do that? And again, this has been kind of the recurring theme on this retreat. Yeah, how to do that? By allowing it to happen naturally. Don't use force. Don't force your mind into the present moment. If you use force, you're going to tire yourself out. The mind is not going to be energized. But if you can let go and relax, the energy will come to the mind, and then the mindfulness will arise all by itself. And this is kind of the easy and the beautiful way of doing it. It's the way that will lead you to a lot of happiness and joy in your meditation practice in the long run, and reduce the suffering to a minimum. So there's going to be a little bit of suffering, that's unavoidable, but minimum, yeah, minimize the problems in life. So you allow the mindfulness to happen. And sometimes you will find that you don't get mindfulness. Yeah, you go on a 4-day retreat and you don't really find that mindfulness. You're always kind of thinking, you're always tired, and you don't really get that sharpness of the mind. And the reason why that is happening is because you still need to develop more of the basic factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So you go back home, and then you apply yourself in daily life. Yeah, you do all the right things. You live your life well to the highest possible standard. You think more about how you live life than what you actually achieve. And the more you focus on the how, on the process of how we deal with people, how we deal with everything, the more you focus on kindness, care, compassion, and all of these wonderful qualities that we develop on this path, you come back next year and you will see that your mindfulness is a little bit sharper. Something has changed. Yeah. And this is how gradually things change. So if you don't feel mindful, it is not because the teachings are no good necessarily. Yeah. It's not because the whatever, you know, it is simply because you need to do more of the preliminary practices. And it takes a long time, yeah? It takes a long time to purify the mind. The more we do this, the more we accumulate all of these things, the more powerful they become in our practice. So there's two ways then of establishing mindfulness. One is what we do in the present moment, which is just relaxing, sitting back, having the right attitude, enjoying being here, having a bit of the right outlook, all of these things I was talking about before. You can only do so much in the present moment. And then there is the long-term practice that also supports mindfulness. Outlook and Sila, Ditti and Sila, Uttruka Ditti and Sila coming together, supporting this practice. So that is the background to the Anapanasati Sutta. And this is, as I said, probably the most important part. If you get this right, everything else tends to flow almost automatically. So what happens next? So once you have established mindfulness, and remember what I said before, that most people go to the breath too quickly. You should only go to the breath once mindfulness has been established. Yeah, this is, I think, one of the, I don't want to criticize anyone too much, but I think this is one of the weaknesses in the Goenka tradition. Somebody here was from the Goenka tradition, and sometimes you are told, sit down, watch the breath straight away. But really, for some people that may work, but for some people it is not the right approach, because sometimes you haven't got mindfulness yet. And if you haven't got mindfulness, according to this sutta, you're not ready. Yeah, you have to wait. And you have to wait to establish mindfulness, and then you go to the breath afterwards. So it is, you know, it is more nuanced than just sitting down and watching the breath. So for some people, the breath comes into the mind straight away. And if it does, that's okay. Just let it be there. Just don't focus too hard on it. Focus instead on your body and let the breath be in the background. Focus on the body, allow the mindfulness to arise. And as you do that, then the breath becomes much more watchable after a while, and then you keep on watching the breath in a better way. So now, when mindfulness is established, now we start watching the breath. And the Buddha says, ever mindful you breathe in, ever mindful you breathe out. And first of all, ever is not the ideal translation. And this is a small Pali word called eva. And eva can mean just. And this is what I think it means in this context. It means just mindful you breathe in, mindful you breathe out. And there is a difference in that, because the idea of ever mindful means always mindful. Yeah, but we haven't got to that point yet. Always mindful comes further down. At this point, you are just mindful. And just mindful means that you don't use any force. You don't use any willpower. Mindfulness is established, and then the meditation happens by itself. Nothing you have to do. Just mindful, and everything happens from that. So sometimes these little things can kind of be have a little bit of significance to them. And then when you're mindful, you breathe in, breathe out, this is what happens next. Breathing in long, you understand, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, you understand, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, you understand, I breathe in short. Breathing out short, you understand, I breathe out short. You train thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body of the breath. You train thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. You train thus, I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the bodily formation. You train thus, I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. So, for those of you who are not used to the suttas, I'm going to explain this, because this probably sounds a little bit cryptic. It should do, because it's kind of slightly weird language, to be honest. So I'll explain what is going on here. So the first thing then is breathing in long. Yeah, you breathe in long, and you know that you're breathing in long. The idea is just that you have enough awareness to be aware of every breath. Yeah, your mind is not very sharp yet, because it's only the beginning of the meditation, not super sharp. You have mindfulness, but you are able to be aware of every breath. And then, and that is really all it means. So why does it have long and then short? What is the reason for that? And the reason for that is probably because many people, when they meditate, they experience that in the beginning, once your mindfulness is established, your breath is quite long. And then as you become a bit more peaceful, the breath often becomes shorter after a while. Yes, there is like a natural sequence there, from long breath to short breath. This is the reason why I think it's there. But remember, this doesn't mean that we should make the breath in this way. This is just the natural appearance of the breath. Our job is not to force the breath to be one way or the other. Our job is just to be aware of the breath. This is just the natural way that the breath appears to us when we are aware of it. Yeah, this is a very important point, because some people think that, yeah, I must make the breath longer. No, please don't make the breath anything. In fact, stand back as much as you possibly can. This is the whole idea of mindfulness, is that it is non-involvement. It is passive awareness. You don't make the breath long, you don't make it short. Whatever it is, it's fine. This is just a general scheme to point out how normally this process happens. Yeah, does it make sense? It's important. I think it's a very important point, because otherwise we start to get involved with the breath and trying to create it this way and that way. And then actually it can become very unpleasant, because any kind of manipulation or trying to make things be, it doesn't feel relaxed, it doesn't feel at ease, because we are manipulating things. So stand back and allow this process to happen. Yeah, so you understand this. And then in the next step, it says, you train in this way. I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body of the breath. So how come it says understand, and then it says train? What is the difference? And the difference is that when you have established mindfulness beforehand, you're already ready to see the long breath and the short breath. It happens automatically. You don't need any more training to get to that point. As long as mindfulness is established, you can see the long breath, you can see the short breath, you can see every breath. It's automatic. But to be able to experience the whole body of the breath, you need to train for a while. It doesn't happen automatically. What is that training? Is that training using willpower? Is that training using some kind of control? No, that training is just giving yourself time. That's all it is. Yeah, so you sit back, and as you watch passively, you are just a passenger on the train, you do as little as possible. As you do that, this happens all by itself. But it takes time, and that's why it is called training here. That time span is a training that you're putting in. It takes sampajanya, clear awareness, so that you're watching the breath in the right way. You don't allow yourself to be drawn away by thinking, by desires, by ill will, and all of these things. And if that happens, then sampajanya kicks in and says, no, I'm going in the wrong way. And then you come back to the breath again, or whatever it is. So that is what is meant by training here. You are aware, you follow the process, and you make sure the process plays out in the same way as it is explained here in this particular sutta. So, what is this whole body? Why does it have "of the breath" in parentheses? Yeah, this parentheses are always a kind of worrying sign when things are in parentheses. Why are they in parentheses? Is that means what is going on here? And the reason why it is in parentheses is because the Pali says sabbakaya patisangvedi. It means literally means experiencing the whole kaya. And kaya is normally understood to mean body. So the breath is supplied from the commentary, and that's why it is in parentheses. It's not actually in the Pali text, in the sutta text. So this is why when you go to certain teachers, they will tell you, well, at this point you have to feel the whole body. Yeah, and others will say you have to feel the whole body of the breath, because the breath is also a body. So which one is right? I think what is right is it means the whole body of the breath. That's what I think it means. And I think there is a lot of good evidence for thinking that. And first of all, it is explained like that in the commentary. Usually the commentaries are quite reliable, so you can trust the commentaries if they say so. But also, this is mindfulness of breathing. That's what it is. So because it is mindfulness of breathing, we should expect each step to have to do with breathing, rather than suddenly going out to the body. And then it says later on in the same sutta, it's not actually included here, but it says later on that the breath is one body among bodies. Yeah, so the breath is called a body in Pali. It is a body because it is a group of things grouped together, like the word body is sometimes used in English. And then if you read the sutta, there is also a Chinese version of the sutta, and the Chinese version says kaya sankara in this place, and kaya sankara is a well-known word for body, physical body, for the breath in the Pali language. So the okay, so sometimes it's very useful to have the Chinese version of the suttas, because the Chinese versions, you can then look at the Chinese and then you will know what the original Sanskrit was based on the Chinese version. So that's very interesting. So all of those things point in that way. But some people still say that it refers to the whole physical body. And if they do that, if it works, yeah, the most important thing, if the meditation works, it's fine. It doesn't matter so much. So if it works for you to watch the breath and watch the body go back to the breath again, you can do that. But I personally don't think that is the ideal way of doing it, because it breaks the flow of what you're doing. The flow is a breath meditation. So let's leave that aside. I'm getting a little bit too technical now, perhaps, but just to kind of draw you into some of the controversies in meditation circles. Is this something that you discuss, Venerables? Do you discuss these kind of issues? Sabbakaya Patisangveda, what that means? Yeah. Exactly. That's the problem. Yeah. So the people. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. That's precisely. Yeah. So yes, everybody discusses this. This is kind of one of the things that you discuss when you've been a monk or nun or layperson for a long time, and you can take part in these discussions. You will know exactly what this is about. Anyway, that's why I'm discussing it. Yeah. So you may think this sounds like a very refined point. But it is something that becomes important as you keep on practicing here. Then we have the last one here. You train thus, I shall breathe in tranquilizing the bodily formations, the kaya sankara. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the bodily formation. And this is well known. Kaya sankara, bodily formation, is a well known word for the breath in the suttas. It is called the bodily formation because it is something that is made by the body. Yeah, it is part of the body. Sankara means formation. It is like a fabrication, or it's constructed by the body, if you like, the breath. The body breathes in and out. So for that reason, that's what it is called. So in this case, it's very obvious what it means. It means you tranquilize the breath. Don't know why the Buddha uses kaya sankara. I don't understand that. But the Buddha uses often a broad, different terms so as to tie the suttas together. And this may be the reason why he uses kaya sankara in this context. So you tranquilize the breath. Yeah? And again, remember, it is an automatic process. There's nothing you need to do. The tranquilization happens all by itself. All you have to do is stand back, be the passive observer, and this process happens all by itself. And already, if you get this far in your meditation, already you will have lots of benefits. Already, sitting there, completely passive, just observing the breath, and the breath being tranquil, already it's a very peaceful and beautiful feeling. That the majority of people who are rushing around doing their ordinary business, they never really feel this in this particular way. So already, you're moving out of the ordinary worldly stream of things and kind of moving on to the tranquility and peace that you find in the Buddhist teachings. So if you can do that much, already wonderful. Even if you can't do that much, it's still often really good because you're already leading it in the right way. But if you can even do this much, it means you already have some of the benefits of the practice. But then, after this is where the real benefits start. But before we get to those, let's have another short break and we'll come back again in 10 minutes. Okay, so let us continue. And so we have looked at the first four steps of the Anapanasati Sutta, and the first four steps, they are equivalent to the first part of the Satipatthana Sutta, which is the Kaya Nupassana, contemplation of the body. That is what the first four steps are equivalent to. And the next four steps, they are equivalent to the Vedana Anupassana, the contemplation of feeling. Yeah. So each four steps in the Anapanasati Sutta covers one of the four Satipatthanas. And this way, all four Satipatthanas are completed, fulfilled by simply by watching the breath. So let's have a look at how the Vedana Anupassana is explained in this particular sutta. And this is how it goes. He trains... Thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing rapture. He trains us. I shall breathe out, experiencing rapture. He trains us. I shall breathe in, experiencing pleasure. He trains us. I shall breathe out, experiencing pleasure. He trains us. I shall breathe in, experiencing the mental formation. He trains us. I shall breathe out, experiencing the mental formation. He trains us. I shall breathe in, tranquilizing the mental formation. He trains us. I shall breathe out, tranquilizing the mental formation. And this, these four steps are really about feelings. How we feel the world, whether good, bad, or neutral. This is all about good feelings, really. And it starts off with a feeling of rapture. And rapture here is the Pali word is piti. And piti is like a joy. You feel joy in the mind. You feel elated. You feel often, you can feel it physically, like kind of joy almost coursing through the body. Very often it's a physical experience as well as a mental one, of course. So as you tranquilize the breath in the previous step, as it becomes more and more fine, more and more delightful, there comes a point when the joy starts to arise in the mind, and you start to feel joyful. And this is where things start to become really beautiful, because now you're starting to taste the spiritual happiness for the first time. Now you start to understand what spiritual happiness actually means. It is very different from the worldly happiness, as I mentioned before. It is something conjoined with peace, something conjoined with the craving and desires dying down. And because the world is dying down, the spiritual qualities are coming out. And these spiritual qualities is the joy, this spiritual joy that arises simply by watching a peaceful object like the breath. And if, again, you feel it kind of coursing through the body, it's very kind of exhilarating. One of the first times that you experience the spiritual happiness. And then from that, as you keep on going with this, the next one is here called the pleasure. Pleasure is sukha in Pali. And the difference between the two is just that as you keep on practicing, the happiness becomes deeper, it becomes more profound. It changes over time. The more peaceful you are, the more at ease you are, the more beautiful the sense of happiness is. So the happiness is just going up. That's what's happening. It's becoming more refined, more spectacular, more spiritual. The world is being left more and more behind. You're moving more and more into the realm of the spiritual, the mind, and all of this. Gradually, stage by stage, piti, sukha, then you have chitta sankhara and patti sangvedi. Chitta sankhara is just another word for feeling and experience. The main experience at this point is the feeling. So you can just think about it as the experience of feeling in all its breadth. It's just another way of talking about the same experience, basically. And then the last one is the calming down, or the tranquilizing of that mental formation, the tranquilizing of the feeling. The feeling becoming more and more peaceful, more and more beautiful. It is now merging with the tranquility. If you remember back, I don't know if you can remember, but if you remember back to what I was talking about the very first day, I was talking about the psychology of meditation. And according to the psychology of meditation, you have first of all the pamuja, the gladness, then the piti, the rapture, then you have the pasadi. Pasadi is a peace of the body, the calm of the body, when there's no agitation, and none of that is kind of completely gone. And then comes the sukha after that. And here the sequence is slightly different, but the tranquility really becomes very powerful at this stage. When you're calming down the piti, and the body settles down and starts to feel very solid. It starts to feel like you can sit on the seat forever. That's what it begins to feel like. You feel like this rock sitting on the seat. So when you feel like a rock, it's good, it's not bad. It's good if you feel like a rock, because you feel solid. It feels like you don't want to do anything else. This is what this is about. So how does this happen? How can we make this happen? Because it is now it is becoming very delightful. You're really getting into the happiness of meditation at this stage. How can we move? One of the problems people sometimes have is moving from the mere tranquility of the breath and then moving on to the joy. Some people find that hard. How do we go from tranquility of the breath to the joy of the mind? And this is sometimes what you need to do that. You need to nudge the mind a little bit. Remember, in meditation, we want to do the minimal amount of effort. So when I say nudge, I mean just very slight little change in perception that is required. Yeah, sometimes, just to kind of move the mind from ordinary peace to a joyful experience. So you need to focus on one of those things that give rise to joy in the mind. And that can be, for example, just a sense of gratitude. Just feeling, wow, how lucky I am to be able to be meditating. Yeah, to be in this retreat center, to be doing practice in this path. How lucky I am to have the Buddha as my teacher here. What a wonderful thing that is. And just having that sense of gratitude can be enough. And you don't need to think very much. It's almost like you're just leaning your mind in that direction. Yeah, and when you do that, the joy arises. And then you go with the breath, the joy and the breath, and then you take it through these steps of feeling. That is one way of doing it. Another way of giving rise to the joy in your meditation is to have metta towards your breath. This is a technique that Ajahn Brahm taught. I remember when I came to Bodhidharma Monastery many, many years ago, to give oomph to your meditation practice, have metta to your breath. Your breath is like this old friend. Yeah, you're kind of on this really interesting journey together into samadhi and meditation, and you have all you have with you is your breath. It's you and your breath together, and you're kind of on there. So thank you, breath, for hanging out with me. It's not as if the breath has much choice, but anyway, you kind of, you know, you make this up as you go along to make it feel nice. So you kind of anthropomorphize the breath. You make the breath into a being almost, and you thank your breath for being there with you. Yeah, and then you kind of go together on this really extraordinarily interesting journey together with the breath. And, you know, you can make this into something nice. You can think of the breath as something that has supported you throughout your whole life. Without our breath, we wouldn't go very far. Yeah, breath is kind of important. So you thank your breath, you have gratitude to it, and you have metta towards it. A sense of kindness towards your breath. And this is another way of bringing rise to the joy. Another way is the Buddha talks about, I mentioned this before, the sila nusati, the chaga nusati, the recollection of things that we have done in the past. So once you become peaceful, sometimes it can be easy to remember a very important thing in the past where you felt a lot of happiness and joy, maybe because of something you did, something, act of kindness or something. And then you allow that to arise in your mind at this particular point. Yeah, very gently. You don't want to do very much because it destroys the peace. But very, very gently turn your mind in that direction. Allow the joy to come up. And then bring that joy in together with the breath. And then carry on. Yeah, back to the breath again. So it's just allowing the mind to be lifted up a little bit. And then you are back on track again. Yeah, and then when you're back on track again, remember the process is automatic. There's nothing here that you really have to do. What I'm talking about that now is just a little nudging of the mind, a very slight movement of the mind, but still the process is supposed to be automatic. So when you come back to the breath again, you allow all of these things to happen automatically. You just stand back and you see the joy coming more and more powerfully. You see all of these steps happening. You see the calming down of the joy or whatever. It just happens by itself. Nothing you have to do. Stand back and watch. Watch all the good things in the world just coming to you. The less you do to get it, the more they come. It's marvelous, isn't it? Usually we are taught to go out and get things for ourselves in the world. You've got to study hard and work hard, then everything's going to work out for you. Here is the opposite. The less you do, the more good things come to you. Isn't that marvelous? It's like turning the world upside down. All you have to do is chill. Wow, and it's all coming to you. It's almost like magic. But it's not really magic. It only works if you have put in all the preliminary steps on the path. So this is then equivalent to the Vedana Nupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta. So now we are going through the Satipatthanas one by one. And the next step here then is the Chitta Nupassana, the contemplation of the mind. So the next four steps are equivalent to the contemplation of the mind in the Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah, one after the other. And this is how this reads in the Anapanasati Sutta. You train thus, I shall breathe in, experiencing the mind. You train thus, I shall breathe out, experiencing the mind. You train thus, I shall breathe in, gladdening the mind. You train thus, I shall breathe out, gladdening the mind. You train thus, I shall breathe in, stilling the mind. You train thus, I shall breathe out, stilling the mind. You train thus, I shall breathe in, liberating the mind. You train thus, I shall breathe out, liberating the mind. So before I say anything about this aspect of mindfulness of breathing, I just want to mention one more thing about the previous set. The previous four factors, you will notice, are all about happy experiences. Yeah, even the experiencing the mental formation is all about the pleasure and happiness that is happening in that meditation experience. And why I want to point that out is that if you remember back to in the Satipatthana Sutta, it talks about contemplating feelings. And it talks about painful feelings and happy feelings and all that. Remember that? Yeah? But here, all you have to do is experience the happy feelings. And by experiencing the happy feelings, you are fulfilling the Satipatthana. You don't actually have to deal with the painful feelings at all. You can leave them out. Yeah? I'm just showing this to you, to show you this good news, isn't it? Don't have to have anything but painful feelings. All you have to do is the happy feelings. It's really good news. How is that possible? What does this discrepancy actually mean? And what it means is that if you come to this particular stage, you have already left the painful feelings behind. You have overcome those painful feelings. That is why now you're experiencing so much bliss. And later on, when you come out of your meditation, you contemplate this, you will be able to understand those painful feelings by their absence, by the fact that they have ceased, that they are gone. That way you will understand them. You will understand them as impermanent. You will understand them as non-self. You will get insight into them precisely because of their absence. So this is kind of the good news. So sometimes in certain meditation techniques you are taught to focus on the painful feelings. But actually, you don't really have to do that according to the Buddha. If you get the Anapanasati right, all you have to do is to focus on the happy feelings. Yeah? It's pretty good. That's a really good deal, I reckon. And this is kind of the beauty about this thing. This is the beauty about studying the suttas in detail. You start to see things that are not normally, not often recognized. Yeah, there are things in there which are very, very uplifting in this particular way. So now we move from the Vedana Nupassana to the Chitta Nupassana. And the very first thing it says here, it says that I shall breathe in experiencing the mind. What does that mean, to experience the mind? What does it mean? And what it means is that the mind is experienced when those things that are not mind start to disappear. What is left when everything that has to do with the body and the five senses, when all of that disappears, what remains is the mind. Yeah. So what is happening at this stage is that you're experiencing so much happiness and all of these things that the body is fading into the background very, very much. The breath is also starting to fade into the background. Your senses are starting to shut down. You already have your eyes closed, but at this point even the hearing is starting to disappear. Yeah, it is fading into the background. And when all the five senses are fading into the background, you can't feel anything, you can hardly hear anything, you can't see anything, then all that is left is really the mental experience. So that experience you have at this point actually is really what the mind is, because the physical things have disappeared. How does this manifest? And very often the way this manifests in your actual experience of meditation is as a bright light. Or not necessarily bright in the beginning, but a light in your mind. Yeah, some people see it like the sun, some people see it like a much more dull thing, like the moon perhaps, something like that. But a light starts to arise in your mind. And this becomes so attractive and powerful that it draws you into the meditation, this experience of the light. And this is really how the mind often is experienced at this particular time. Yeah, and this is what is meant by the mind. The body, the senses are falling away. The mind is what remains. So how do we make this transition from happiness to the mind? How do we come to this nimitta? When we come to these things called often called nimittas, not actually called that in the suttas, but in ordinary speech, they're called nimittas most of the time. How do we make this transition from the beautiful breath, the rapture and the happiness, to this nimitta? It's another transition. Whenever you make a transition, you have to be careful. And many people say that when the nimitta arises, I get so excited, I lose it straight away. Or I become frightened. I become frightened because it's so powerful. Very, very, very common experiences. So what you have to do is that you, when the nimitta comes, is you not to kind of be too concerned about it. The reason why you get excited is because you want to go to it straight away. You want to experience all the happiness. But actually, if the nimitta arises, you just kind of be cool about it. Say, oh yeah, whatever. Nimitta, welcome. If you disappear straight away, it's okay. So you don't kind of take it too seriously. You just allow it to come. And only when that nimitta becomes quite steady and quite stable and it's there, it gains a certain strength, only then do you kind of make the transition from the beautiful breath to the nimitta. In this way you can avoid the excitement and the fear that comes with it. You don't take it too seriously. You say, whatever, go back to the breath again. Strengthen the sense of what you have already, then go to the nimitta when you are ready. Now it's already getting incredibly profound. The vast majority of meditators, they never see a nimitta, but this is what will happen if you keep on developing your mind. And then it gets even more profound, because now the next steps now in this sequence are all about how to develop that nimitta, develop that light in the mind, so that it becomes more and more powerful. Initially it may be a bit dull, and because it is a bit dull, the next thing to do is to gladden it, to make it more happy, to give it more power. How do we do that? The way you do that, again, is not by doing anything, but just standing back and allowing things to develop. Everything is about allowing the process to happen all by itself. So you stand back, you just focus on the nimitta, passive observer, passenger on the train, nothing you have to do. And as you do that, the nimitta gladdens itself. It all happens all by itself. This is one of the aspects of how to make this more powerful. The other aspect, which is the third step here, is stilling the mind. It's here called concentrating, but stilling is probably better. So you still that nimitta. In other words, the nimitta sometimes may not be perfectly still, so you just focus on it, and you just leave your attention on it until it becomes perfectly still. The reason why it's not perfectly still is because your mind is still a little bit restless. There's still some movement there. But as you stay on that nimitta, your attention stays there, things become more and more peaceful, more and more sublime. Again, there's nothing you have to do. It's an automatic process. You just stand back. And the nimitta becomes more and more brilliant. More and more powerful. Until you don't know what's going to happen next. You just kind of, this is out otherworldly. You are in a different world now. You're entering a different realm. And you wonder, what on earth is going to happen next? I can't stand all this place. I don't know if I can take it all. Some people feel like that when they get to this particular point, because it's so incredibly powerful. The nimitta is like this sun arising in your mind, brilliant and powerful. And this is how this works. And there comes a point in this whole experience, in this whole dealing with the mind, when suddenly something flips. When you merge with the nimitta, you fall into the nimitta, but something changes. And that is the point when the mind is liberated. And the liberation here, what it means that you enter a state of deep samadhi, like a jhana state. That is when everything just merges, and everything becomes one. And that is how you know it is a real samadhi state. There's no duality anymore. There's no distinction between you and the object. It's just one thing. And that is why people think that samadhi is unity with God, because duality has disappeared. You have ekatta, ekagata, all of these things that mean unity of the mind. Complete unity. There's no sense of duality in the world. Again, you have entered a completely different realm. You have left the body behind. You have no access to the body anymore. You have no access to the five senses. You can't even want to see, because the mind is not capable of that kind of motion anymore, to want anything. But there's no hearing, no seeing, nothing is completely gone. And you have entered a different world. This is called the Rupa Loka, or the Rupa Avachara, at this particular point. And this is a jhana attainment. This is what is waiting for you. And it's very strange, very unusual, very different from everything else, but incredibly worthwhile. You realize now you have entered something extraordinarily unwholesome, extraordinarily positive, something which is just completely beyond your wildest fantasies, that actually it is possible to reach such things. And it doesn't stop there, then it continues beyond that. Yeah, this is kind of the amazing thing about this particular path. So that is the liberation of the mind. This is a preliminary liberation that happens in the jhana states. You're liberated from the senses and the body, and you're liberated from the five hindrances. Yeah, the hindrances are completely gone. Your mind is completely purified at this particular stage. So that is the equivalent of the citta vipassana. Yeah, and again, all positive qualities, all powerful, beautiful things, no need to contemplate any bad things at all. And this is where the samatha comes to its peak. You have now reached the last factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. And then the last four factors of Anapanasati Sutta, they are roughly equivalent to Dhamma Nupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah? So now we come to the very last four, and this is where the insight comes. So you will notice here, you do the samadhi, 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 yeah? And then when you come out of the samadhi, only then, now comes the vipassana, or the insight part. This is how it is explained in the Anapanasati Sutta. So let's have a look at this very last part. And this is how it reads in the Anapanasati Sutta. You train thus, I shall breathe in contemplating impermanence. This is anicca. You train thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating impermanence. You train thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating fading away. You train thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating fading away. You train thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating cessation. You train thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating cessation. You train thus, I shall breathe in, contemplating relinquishment. You train thus, I shall breathe out, contemplating relinquishment. So what does all this mean? What are we contemplating? What is the difference? What do all of these words mean? Impermanence, fading away. What is the connection between these things? And what this means, impermanence, just means that things are always changing. Yeah, that's what impermanence means. So, you know, in the beginning, as you are watching the breath, you can see the breath changing. If it is long, then it's short. You can see the feelings changing. You may have a bit of suffering to begin with, then the suffering fades away. Initially, you may still hear a lot of things, and the hearing kind of becomes different. Yeah, so things are impermanent. This is the first aspect here, impermanence, anicca. The second one is the viraga, and the viraga is a more profound aspect of impermanence. All of these things are about impermanence, anicca, one way or another, but there are different degrees of impermanence. So fading away is not just things kind of coming and going. Fading away is when things actually start to disappear. Yeah, so you see, as you go through the process of your meditation, you see that things start to disappear as you go through the process. The body starts to disappear. The breath starts to disappear. Yeah, everything becomes less and less. Certain feelings start to disappear. They fade away, become less and less and less. And they keep on fading until the point where they disappear completely. And that is the third factor here, the cessation, the nirodha. Nirodha means an ending of these things. And in many ways, the ending or the disappearance or the cessation of things, the nirodha, this is like the real impermanence that we're trying to get to. Yeah, because when things disappear, that is like absolute impermanence. They're completely gone. And that is the impermanence that really matters. And this is why it is so useful to get into a state of samadhi. Because when you get into a state of samadhi, things have really disappeared. A lot of things have gone completely. So it is impossible, it is almost be quiet that you will understand impermanence once you get into samadhi, because it's all gone. If it's all gone, well, it means it's completely impermanent. Yeah, it's just blooming obvious at a particular point. Because it's blooming obvious, you will see it. So this is one of the reasons why samadhi is so powerful and why it is so useful. The nirodha of the things around you become very clear. And then beyond that is the relinquishment. And the relinquishment means that when you see the cessation again and again and again, you are undermining the craving for these things. Craving eventually disappears completely. And when you craving for things disappear completely, that means you relinquish them. Yeah, they are no longer yours. You're no longer attached to them. There's nothing you desire anymore. And that is the relinquishment that happens here. Relinquishment is called patinisaga. And patinisaga is one of the factors of the third noble truth. Yeah, the tanha, which is mutto, analio, patinisago, etc., chaga. That is the same thing you see here. In other words, you abandon the craving. Yeah, that is the relinquishment of these things. You give them up. You no longer have any ownership of these things. It's the final stage in impermanence when you discard it altogether. So what is it that we contemplate in this way? What is it that we contemplate impermanence, fading away, cessation, and relinquishment of? What are these phenomena? And what it is? It is the process you have just been through. Yeah, we have just been looking at the process of the breath, how the breath becomes more and more refined, how you get all these extraordinary feelings, and how you move to the mind, and how eventually you move to samadhi. Now that process is exactly a process that has these characteristics. That process is a process of impermanence. Yeah, you will have noticed that already, I'm sure, in your meditation practice. When you become peaceful, why is it that you become peaceful? Because certain things have disappeared. Yeah, the thinking mind has faded away and disappeared. The body starts to fade away and disappear. All of you probably have a little bit of experience of that already. Some of you have a lot of experience of that. You can see this process of fading away. And one of the first things that you notice when you see that experience, the body fading away, the thinking fading away, the senses fading away, the painful feelings fading away, the coarse happy feelings fading away, being replaced by more refined happy feelings. The will, the tanha fading away, the mind becoming more and more peaceful. One of the things that you see when you do that, you see that all of the things that fade away, they are dukkha. When they fade away, you feel better. Yeah. So if you feel better when they fade away, it means that there must be dukkha. So one of the insights you have by contemplating this is, first of all, impermanence. And as a consequence of that, you also contemplate dukkha at the same time. It's obvious to you because you can see it right there in your own experience. When these things disappear, you feel better that these things must have been dukkha. So you can let go of these things much more easily in the future when you understand that they are problematic. And in this way, by contemplating, remember at the end of each meditation, I ask you to take stock of what's happened. How does the meditation flow? What has happened in the meditation? And part of that is to understand the process of how things are impermanent, how they fade away, and how the coarser aspects of this are dukkha. So in the future, you can abandon these things more easily next time you sit down. And the other thing that you see with these things, and this becomes especially clear when things disappear completely, when they cease, is that there must be non-self. There must be non-self, because if something can be completely gone, you have no access to the body, you have no access to the senses, you have no access to the will and all of that. If you have no access to it, it cannot be an inherent part of you. Anything which is an inherent part of you, you must always be able to access it somehow. If something is completely gone, it is like it's alien to you. It's got nothing to do with you anymore. So in this way, you actually see also non-self at the same time. So this is what is meant here by the insight based on this process you have been through. It just refers to the process of meditation. Looking back on that process after you come out is what it's all about. You see the body disappearing, the senses disappearing, the will disappearing, everything going away. You look back, and then the insight happens as a consequence. So that is at the process of Anapanasati. All of this is very profound, but there is many different levels to this, so you can start to see this already fairly early on, but it becomes much more profound as you deepen your meditation and you take these things to the deepest possible level. And that then is the last factor of the Anapanasati, and that fulfills the Satipatthana. So when you do that, you actually complete the entire course of Satipatthana practice, and then you come to the seven factors of awakening, you fulfill that, and then you fulfill the vijja and the liberation, and you come to the very end of the path, just by doing one thing, just by watching the breath, nothing else that you have to do. So, then the Buddha says, the very last line here, he says, because that is how mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, so that it is of great fruit and great benefit. So, that is why I left that sutta till last, because it is actually, in many ways, very profound. But what it does, it gives you like a roadmap for what this meditation experience is about. It gives you an idea of where you are heading in the future. Yeah, and so all of you will probably be somewhere on this roadmap. Some will be earlier, some in the middle, and some will be later, depending on how your meditation is going. But you will be somewhere there. So this will then give you the encouragement and give you the map to take you further in your practice. And also what is so nice about this, it is so inspiring, yeah, it is so powerful. When I read these kind of things, it makes your hair stand on end, because it's so, it's just all about happiness, it's all about meaning, it's all about going somewhere where you, you know, you actually discover, as I always like to say, you always discover what this life is all about, the purpose of all of these things. You come to understand yourself in a very profound way, understanding your mind, understanding your body, and as you gain that wisdom, of course wisdom is required. If you want to make good decisions about how to live your life, what is worthwhile and what is not, you have to have wisdom, you have to have clarity, you have to understand what the world is like, what you are like, and then you can make informed decisions about what you should be doing, how you should live your life. If you have wrong view, you're always going to do wrong things. That is true also in ordinary life. If you have right view, then you can do things that are appropriate to that right view, and then you can live better and more fruitfully as a consequence. So, I hope that makes sense to you, and if it doesn't make full sense, don't despair, because it takes a while for these things to sink in. I love to read the suttas every year, because I always find that I learn something every time I read the suttas. And I read them much more frequently than you do, but I still get inspired. Every time I do a retreat, I read the suttas. And I do, how many retreats a year? Quite a lot, yeah? Here, Singapore, Malaysia, Sri Lanka, I do retreats in the UK, down in Jhana Grove. And I always find these things very inspiring, because I know that this is, I know, you know, you have, after a while, you know a little bit about this, and you know that this is where life finds true meaning and true purpose. Anyway, that is all for now, and we're going to meet back again at 3 o'clock, yeah? So we'll meet back, we'll have lunch, and then we'll see you back again at 3 o'clock this afternoon.